Hyundai says it will appeal a verdict awarding millions of dollars to the families of two Montana teens killed in a Hyundai vehicle. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Conrad Scheid. And that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about a meeting of officials worried about protecting your water. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with Missoula County Attorney candidate Kirsten Papps about her views on that office. A Montana jury has ordered Hyundai to pay $240 million in punitive damages after finding that a manufacturing defect in a Hyundai vehicle caused a crash that killed two Missoula cousins in July 2011. Lake County jurors late yesterday awarded actual damages of $1 million to each parent and $500,000 to each sibling of 19-year-old Trevor Olson and 14-year-old Tanner Olson, who died in the head-on crash. Jurors also ruled Trevor Olson's estate should receive $2.6 million for lost earnings. It's unclear if the punitive damages will stand. Montana has a $10 million cap on such damages, but that's being challenged after a district court judge in Butte ruled it wasn't high enough to deter future wrongdoing by wealthy companies. Hyundai Motor America released a statement today saying the verdict was mistaken and it planned an immediate appeal.
And in other news from around the state, a lawmaker who faces possible impeachment over claims that his campaign took illegal corporate contributions has filed a constitutional challenge to the law he is accused of breaking. Republican Representative Mike Miller of Helmville says the ban on corporate contributions is a ban on a form of political free speech. Miller is one of two sitting legislators accused of taking illegal in-kind contributions and coordinating their 2010 legislative campaigns with a conservative group called Western Tradition Partnership. Commissioner of Political Practices Jonathan Modell filed civil actions against Miller and Senate Majority Leader Art Wittig, along with seven other Republican candidates. If a judge upholds Modell's findings, Miller and Wittig could be removed from office and as candidates from the 2014 ballot. Miller and Wittig deny any wrongdoing.
A Teachers and Government Workers Union is petitioning the Montana Supreme Court to reject a proposed ballot initiative. The proposed ballot measure seeks to reverse a previous high court decision to raise taxes on Charter Communications Montana property to the 6% telecommunications services rate instead of the 3% cable television rate. The Attorney General's office approved Charter's ballot language, and the measure was cleared for signature gathering earlier this month. MEAFFT President Eric Fever told the Lee Newspapers of Montana yesterday the union is challenging whether the initiative is legal. The union says the ballot statement is untrue, argumentative, and would require the expenditure of funds from the state treasury, which only the legislature can do. Attorney General spokesman John Barnes says his office is reviewing that challenge.
Cascade County has passed a measure banning food, drinks, and guns from polling places on Election Day. The Great Falls Tribune reports the new policy also forbids candidates or elected officials from being poll watchers or observers, and poll watchers must check in with the elections administrator. Plus, petition signature gatherers will not be allowed inside polling locations. County commissioners passed the measure yesterday after a complaint by a Republican lawmaker after the 2012 elections. Former state representative Cleve Loney said Democratic state senators Anders Blewett passed out water and snacks to voters waiting in line at Montana Expo Park. Loney also complained Democratic state representative Carly Boland temporarily filled in for an election judge who had to leave. The commissioner of political practices dismissed Loney's complaint for insufficient evidence.
When most of us open the tap or flush the toilet, we don't think about where that water came from or is going. There are, on the other hand, hundreds of Montanans who devote their professional lives to ensuring Montanans have access to sufficient amounts of unquestionably safe water. Representatives from the Montana section of the American Water Works Association and the Montana Water Environment Association are holding their 89th annual conference in Missoula this week. Mountain Water Company Chief Engineer Logan McGinnis also serves as a chapter representative of the American Water Works Association. McGinnis says there's nothing more important than our modern safe water standards.
You know, we all kind of forget, but, you know, 100 years ago, people weren't getting treated water. I think I talked this morning, a guy said that a state the size of Montana would have had, on average, between, I think he said, 250 and 1,000 deaths per year from waterborne illness. And so, you know, we've come a long ways. You know, it's pretty rare for people to get sick from public drinking water supplies. So we've done a lot of great work, but there's certainly more to be done.
McGinnis says wastewater professionals attending this week's conference will hear more this week about the need to remove more nutrients from wastewater treatment systems.
The nutrients are what gets into the rivers and cause algae to grow. And then that causes depletion of oxygen, and it impairs the quality of the rivers. So that's why nutrients are so important to remove from wastewater. Yeah. Nutrients are a good thing, but you put too much of them in a river and algae starts to grow. So it's nitrogen and phosphorus. People put too much fertilizer on their lawns and it runs into the river and it causes the same problem. So wastewater treatment systems are just one of the sources for nutrients in the river, but they're sort of the easiest one to improve, I guess. Non-point source pollution is a lot harder to improve than point source pollution like a wastewater treatment facility.
He says it's widely acknowledged the United States isn't investing enough into maintaining its water infrastructure.
Whether it's treatment or just the piping systems, they're old. Around the country, a lot of pipes in the ground, including our own, are over 100 years old, and they're not going to last, for a lot longer. So nationally, we do need to step up our investment in infrastructure, whether it's just replacing collection systems and water distribution pipes or whether it's building new treatment plants to improve treatment. There's a lot of need out there, and I believe it's a very important thing that our country needs to pay more attention to. That's why we're all here today. We all believe in that and want to improve on what we're doing and treat our water better and clean up our rivers.
McGinnis predicts climate change will present ongoing water-related challenges.
Our snow is going to run off earlier in the year. We might get the same amount of precip, but it's going to run off a lot sooner. And so a lot of the surface water systems are really going to suffer if they're relying on flows in the river to late summertime. That's when people want the water to water their lawns and things. So I would say climate change can have a huge impact on drinking water systems. Yeah, we're fortunate here as a headwater state. I don't think we're having the same type of issues that California is, but it doesn't mean we're not going to. We're continuing to grow. There's more demand on the water resources. And as the climate continues to change, it's going to shift when those resources are available.
The conference continues tomorrow in Missoula.
Idaho officials say they will ask the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for an emergency stay while they fight a federal judge's decision to allow same-sex marriages in the state starting on Friday. U.S. District Judge Magistrate Judge Candy Dale overturned Idaho's ban on same-sex marriages yesterday, and today she refused to put pending marriages on hold while Governor C.L. Butch Otter and Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin appeal. Matrimonial law expert Seymour Reisman said the appellate court is likely to issue the stay, and the U.S. Supreme Court is almost certain to take up the matter. Former State Senator Nicole Lefevre says gay couples would still be open to housing and employment discrimination because they are not covered by Idaho's Human Rights Act. The Idaho Republican Party issued a statement reaffirming the organization's stance against same-sex marriages.
A physician therapist has pleaded guilty to breaking into patients' homes in the Scobie area and stealing prescription pain medication. The Billings Gazette reports 31-year-old Kevin Criswell pleaded guilty yesterday to conspiracy to acquire a controlled substance by subterfuge. U.S. District Judge Susan Waters scheduled sentencing for September 10th. Sentencing guidelines do not recommend a prison term. Criswell was charged after people who had undergone physical therapy at the Scobie Hospital noticed their pain medication wasn't working. When they contacted the pharmacist, they were told their pill bottles contained over-the-counter pain medication and not the opiates they were prescribed. Assistant U.S. Attorney Brendan McCarthy says there were 91 victims. Criswell, a former University of Montana basketball player who now works in Libby, says he has completed outpatient treatment and is in a recovery group.
Kalispell authorities say someone burned a foam pole vault mat on the Glacier High School track, causing $40,000 in damage. School officials say yesterday's fire destroyed the school's pole vault pits and damaged the pole vault standards, the rubber runway, a fence, and the concrete surface. Kalispell Fire Chief Dave Deadman tells the Flathead Beacon it's not clear whether the fire was set intentionally because most of the evidence was consumed in the blaze. Glacier Activities Director Mark Dennehy says investigators are analyzing video surveillance images and other leads. A $1,000 reward is being offered for the arrest and conviction of whoever is responsible.
Two female Siberian tigers that have been living in a Florida zoo are expected to arrive at their new home in Billings next week. Zoo Montana director Jeff Ewald tells the Billings Gazette the 19-month-old tigers are coming from Dade City's Wild Things near Tampa, Florida. Ewald says RBC Wealth Management is paying for the $4,000 cost of the cross-country trip in a climate-controlled truck. Zoo Montana employees have been doing some work on the tiger enclosure, which has left empty after the death of an 18-year-old tiger, Prince, earlier this year. Ewalt says glass panels that had been cracked have been replaced and new signs installed. Female Siberian tigers are expected to live for about 20 years in captivity, compared to about 14 years in the wild. Only about 500 Siberian tigers remain in the wild.
The Democratic primary race for Missoula County Attorney is more high profile than usual this election. First, since there is no Republican candidate, the winner of the primary will be the next county attorney. Secondly, the current county attorney, Fred Van Valkenburg, has made headlines because of his legal fight with the Federal Justice Department over his office's past handling of sexual assault cases. The two Democratic candidates, Kristen Pabst and Josh Van de Wettering, are both Missoula attorneys currently in private practice who have worked in the county attorney's office. We'll have a feature interview with Van de Wettering tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition. In tonight's feature, Kristen Pabst talks with News Director Sally Mock about the issues in the race and about why she left the county attorney's office after working there for 18 years.
The biggest reason is I needed to spend more time with my family. I was working pretty crazy hours and just investing so much of myself into the job that it was taking a toll on the family, and I needed a break. I had never done anything besides prosecution and civil work on behalf of the county as well, but I'd never done anything but government service like that. And needed to try something different. I think there was also that layer of the culture shift, a gradual culture shift in the office. And for lack of a better term, this line in the sand culture almost, this win at all costs, it got to the point where it seemed like it was more important to be right than it was to do the right thing or to solve a problem. And I tried in many different ways to effect positive change while I was there. And I'm really proud of the work that I've done and that I did and the changes that we made. But I got to a point within the confines of the current administration that kind of had reached a point where there was a conflict with my internal values and what was going on in the office. And
can you be more specific, because that sounds a little vague? Can you give an example, for example, of where you thought that the office was wanting to be right more than to do the right thing?
Well, I think we've seen a lot of examples of that recently. The situation with the Millers at the Dunroven Ranch, where the county has basically drawn a line in the sand, taken a position, and then has opted to throw as many resources as necessary to prove that the county's right. And they're continually having that checked by the judge. The judge is unhappy. The community is unhappy. Millers are obviously unhappy, and it's taken quite a dramatic toll on them in multiple ways besides just their business. The county's been ordered to pay attorney's fees because its approach in some of these areas has been so egregious. Another example is the stance regarding the Department of Justice and the refusal to even talk to them about what their concerns are.
Let's talk about the DOJ investigation, because that certainly has been the biggest headline out of the county attorney's office for the last 18 months or more. That investigation said that the office was really failing its sexual assault victims, and that failure was happening during the time you were the lead prosecutor.
I think it's important to note that the Department of Justice report, if you look at the print, interviewed a variety of people, including law enforcement, victims of crime, and one prosecutor. That one prosecutor was me. I approached them with a cooperative attitude from the very beginning, because I really truly am about trying to solve problems and make the community a safer place. So I know that I have sort of been associated and lumped in with vaguely with those problems, painted with a very broad brush. But if you look a little deeper, I was with the department and still am with the department in trying to identify some problems. But I think even more important than identifying problems is identifying solutions. They have proposed several.
Before we talk about that, we'll get to that. I want to talk a little bit more about the problems they identified, because they had some really damning things to say about how some attorneys in the county attorney's office had dealt with victims. You've disputed those stories. You don't think they're true, right? For example, that someone said to someone, boys will be boys.
I think that there are problems in the way sexual assault cases were handled. However, yeah, you're right. I can't imagine that any of those professional people would have said something like that. And I can tell you that it would not have been tolerated by anybody in the administration. Those kinds of comments, absolutely mm-hmm.
So
unacceptable.
So what problems were there then, if not those? What were the problems?
A big one was a lack of responsiveness to victims, a lack of communication, lack of coordination with the Crime Victim Advocates Office, lack of coordination with our partner law enforcement agencies.
So the obvious question would be to ask you who were in the office then, why didn't you do something about that?
I did what I could at the time within the confines of the current administration. I'm going to get back to that discussion we were having about the Department of Justice and the solutions, because at the time I had made recommendations that I made to them later and they are making now to try to address some of those problems. Those recommendations include hiring a victim witness coordinator, an internal one, to work with our external Crime Victim Advocates Office. Another one of those recommendations was to hire an in-house investigator to build better cases and to help screen cases more efficiently and effectively.
The current county attorney says, and the county commissioners, I think, would agree, they don't have the money to do that.
We're at the point where this is a problem. We need to find the money. It is a priority. And if it's not a priority, then we need to look at what our priorities are and how we can change them.
You have just said that you would like to have and have been cooperating with DOJ about all this. Mr. Van Valkenburg's contention is that they are sticking their nose in where they shouldn't, that local prosecutors have to have the ability to have local control and not have the federal government come in and say, you will do this or you will do that. Do you think he has a point?
I think he has a point. And a federal judge is going to decide that question fairly soon. And so I'm going to rely on what the federal judge says. But what we need to do, I think, is back up a couple three years and look at how did we get here? How did we get to this point? And with changing our approach years back and shift pivoting a little bit from this win at all costs to spirit of cooperation, how can we solve problems? I truly think that we could have avoided getting to this point where we had to draw another line in the sand.
But you, just back to the point, you do think that line should have been drawn?
I don't.
You don't?
I don't think we should have gotten to this point where it should have been drawn. I don't think it's necessary, and those litigation dollars could very well be spent in other places.
The other high-profile thing in your race is, of course, your defense of Jordan Johnson in that trial. You got a lot of blowback for that, I bet.
A little bit. I think for the most part, though, the community really supports what we did for Jordan. I was surprised by the emotional response by some people in the community about my decision to represent him. But nobody's going to dispute that everybody's entitled to a trial before a jury of their peers and a good defense. And that's what we did for Jordan. And we believed 100% that he was innocent at the beginning. And the jury confirmed that very swiftly after the trial. So for the most part, people recognize from a broader sense that the experience as a prosecutor combined with the experience as a defense attorney like that actually gives me some more perspective and a little bit even a greater ability to kind of troubleshoot and solve some of those problems.
How would you describe your relationship with your former colleagues in the county attorney's office?
It's good with some of them. Others, it's strained, particularly the folks that were involved in Jordan's case. I think part of that is, again, this culture that they've been living in, this culture of overreacting. I've seen another emotion, you know, we've seen some more emotional outbursts. And it's not just overreacting emotionally, but legally through litigation and financially through resources. So I just think this is one of the many examples that kind of support my whole position that we need to change our approach.
What changes would you like to see in the office besides the one you've mentioned about hiring a victim witness advocate and an in-house investigator?
I would like to look at a formal diversion program for low-risk offenders. The statutes, the legislature has provided a diversion, which essentially means low-risk of first-time offenders that we don't think are going to go out and reoffend. We have their attention. We're going to divert them away from the court process and on more of a treatment or rehabilitation route. We do very little of that. The current administration is opposed to doing, and they call them deferred prosecution agreements. I agree that it's not appropriate in every case, but there are certainly cases that the county is currently litigating that we could save money in that regard. There's also a relatively new part of the criminal code that provides for criminal mediation. And we've seen such great things happen with alternative dispute resolution in the civil field that I'm kind of excited to try that in the criminal realm. Some cases where it's just a sitting down with a mediator might make all the difference. And I don't think people realize how expensive trials are to the taxpayers. But they're very, very expensive. And to the extent that we can avoid that and still keep the community safe and still make restitution to victims, I think we should explore that.
What is the answer, do you think, in Missoula to reducing the incidence of sexual assault?
Education. Integrating some of these ideas that we're researching and learning about into the community. And we've made great strides in that regard. The university has done wonderful things in the last year, as has the Missoula Police Department implementing their special victims unit. And that's another thing that I think the county attorney's office could mimic in regard to designating specialists and then getting them training that they need. So if we have folks who are really trained up on how to handle these cases instead of now, you know, there's a real variety in embezzlement, drugs, you know, we specialize a little bit, but if we could really earmark people and then get them trained up and get them continual state-of-the-art relevant training. But the biggest piece, I think, is just that gradual culture shift in education.
Well, I have been speaking with Kirsten Pabst, who's a Missoula attorney who wants to become Missoula's new county attorney. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sally. Appreciate it.
Sally will interview the other candidate in the Missoula County Attorney's race, Josh Vandewettering, tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, tonight should be partly cloudy with lows in the mid-30s to lower 40s. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain and highs in the 70s to lower 80s. For central Montana tonight, look for mostly cloudy skies, isolated showers and thunderstorms in the evening with lows 40 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain through the day and a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon with highs 65 to 70 degrees. For southwest Montana tonight, look for mostly cloudy skies in the evening, then becoming partly cloudy with lows 35 to 40 degrees. And tomorrow should be partly cloudy with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon and highs 65 to 75 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Kohler.
Good evening. I'm Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, the area agency on aging for Missoula and Ravalli counties. Because May is Mental Health Month, tonight I want to talk about the importance of maintaining good mental health and seeking appropriate treatment if your mental health is suffering, especially as this subject pertains to older adults. Not a day passes that we don't read or hear about the importance of healthy lifestyle. Much emphasis is put on regular exercise, eating right, and getting a good night's sleep to keep our bodies as healthy as possible, especially as we age. However, good health involves more than only caring for the body. A healthy mind is equally important. In fact, our mental health is integral to our overall health. Far too many Americans fail to incorporate this principal component into their health choices. Yet overall health and wellness are not possible without it. If you were to ask your friend, spouse, or neighbor to define mental health, they may respond that it is a state of mind, being content with life, or feeling good about yourself. Simply put, mental health is the ability to cope with daily life and the challenges it brings. When a person has good mental health, they deal better with what comes their way. By contrast, poor mental health, such as feeling overwhelmed by high levels of stress, can make even day-to-day life difficult. This can also lead to mental illnesses such as depression and anxiety. Most people feel sad, blue, unhappy, miserable, or down in the dumps for short periods from time to time. But true clinical depression is an illness, a mood disorder in which feelings of sadness, loss, anger, or frustration interfere with daily life for weeks or longer. While I believe our society has come a long way towards understanding mental health and mental illness, neither has the same mainstream awareness level as other medical issues like diabetes, heart disease, or cancer. Most people still do not recognize the importance of good mental health, let alone understanding mental illness, especially as it pertains to themselves. We may talk about being stressed or overwhelmed, but do we recognize the impact this has on our overall health? Many older adults still feel a stigma associated with the idea that they may be suffering from clinical depression, so they say little to others, including their healthcare provider. Having this perception only deprives a person of living life to its fullest. As we grow older, we face different challenges. The triggers for depression are many: social isolation and loneliness, physical decline, effects of medication, major surgery, death of a spouse or lifelong friend. A recent study posted on Medline Plus looked into what may lead older adults to consider suicide. Most research has suggested that depression is the major cause. However, this study suggests the main factors that may trigger thoughts of death and suicide among older adults are health, money, and family problems. Research also suggests that predispositions for mental illness, including depression and anxiety, may be genetically based. Despite all of this, the best news is that mental illness, like depression and anxiety, are very treatable if you seek help. Start by being honest with your medical provider about how you feel. Delve into family history to see if there are any indications that other family members may have mental health issues, whether diagnosed or not. Your medical provider may prescribe medication, often in combination with talk therapy. But not everyone is willing to acknowledge their symptoms, take medication, or continue a course of treatment if the first attempt didn't work as they wanted. Options for dealing with mental illness do not necessarily guarantee a quick fix or that a current fix will be effective for the rest of your life. Individual responses to different treatment protocols vary widely, and positive results can take time. Bear in mind that achieving or restoring good mental health is a journey, one in which we need a trusted and knowledgeable medical provider who is committed to working with you along the way. The process may be temporary or lifelong, but it starts with acknowledging that you want to feel better. Everyone deserves good mental health. Feeling down in the dumps over a long period of time does not need to be a normal part of aging. Let's remind ourselves during Mental Health Month that a healthy mind is achievable at any age and, with the treatment options available today, more attainable than ever before. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, and as always, thanks for listening.
Susan Kohler is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Conrad Scheid.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.